Hey, everybody, we're talking about the New York Times' 1619 project for the first half of today's show. And you can really draw a clear line from the earliest days of slavery to the racial wealth gap and the economic picture of this country today. Today, 400 years since slavery began in the United States, we're going to draw some of those connections and make them explicit with William Darity, who goes by Sandy. He's the director of the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke University.
Slavery contributed to the economic growth of the United States as a collectivity, particularly after the formation of the Republic in 1776. The classic phrase that cotton is king is a phrase that really did have substance because it was the preeminent sector in the country. And associated with that was the sustained exploitation of enslaved labor to produce the cotton. So we refer accurately to slave-grown cotton. And so if we look at the cotton sector's impact, say, on New York City, the growth and development of New York City was very closely connected to the successes that New York-based entrepreneurs had that was linked to the cotton sector. The state of Connecticut's textile sector was connected, obviously, to cotton as well. So cotton had a nationwide impact on economic growth.
Sandy, do we have any idea of the scope of, how much money was lost stolen from African slaves for this type of labor?
My colleague Thomas Kramer at the University of Connecticut says that we should count every 24-hour segment as time that was stolen from the individuals who were enslaved. And I think using that as a gauge, he comes up with an estimate of the total amount of labor seized or appropriated from enslaved black folks in the vicinity of $12 to $14 trillion.
Let's talk a little bit about post-Reconstruction. What were some of the policies once slavery was abolished post-Reconstruction that continued to have an economic impact on black wealth versus white wealth?
I think the most decisive policy was actually a policy that was not implemented. The formerly enslaved promise land grants of 40 acres. And actually, General Sherman began the process of allocating those land grants to folks who had been newly emancipated. And that policy was reversed after President Lincoln was assassinated by his successor, Andrew Johnson. And so with the reversal of that policy, there was a sustained and systematic denial of access to an initial endowment in land on the part of the formerly enslaved. And I think that that's the foundation for the kinds of inequalities we observe today in terms of black-white wealth differences.
Well, let's talk about that. You and I have talked about this for years now. It's something known as the racial wealth gap. Let's draw that line from slavery, post-Reconstruction, Jim Crow, to this racial wealth gap we're experiencing. The last numbers that I understand are that white Americans, again, on average, have about 10 to 13 times the wealth that black Americans do in this country.
Yeah, but another way to think about it is that black Americans own about 2.6% of the nation's wealth, but constitute closer to 13% of the nation's population. So the black share in the nation's wealth falls far below the black share of the nation's population. And it would suggest that if you were going to eliminate that disparity, it would require an expenditure in the vicinity of $10 to $12 trillion. So that's the task that I would personally set for a reparations program if one was inaugurated in the United States. But the magnitude of the racial wealth gap or gulf is immense, and it would require a correspondingly immense program of restitution.
Sandy, you mentioned reparations, and we've talked a lot about this here on The Takeaway. Some folks have criticized reparations as being purely economic or just a check. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't view a check as something that is something that's trivial or unimportant. Given the magnitude of the huge differences in wealth that we have been talking about, an appropriately sized check, if you will, would exactly be what we need as a mechanism for getting rid of that enormous wealth gap. I don't think that a reparations program for Black descendants of persons who were enslaved in the United States necessarily has to be limited to direct payments to eligible recipients, although that's been the characteristic of many, many reparations programs internationally, whether we're thinking about the reparations program that Germany inaugurated to compensate or to provide restitution to the victims of the Holocaust, whether we're talking about the United States' own program of reparations for Japanese Americans who were unjustly incarcerated in the United States, or whether we're talking about the reparations that were provided to families who lost loved ones in the 9/11 tragedy. All those cases, there are significant amounts of monetary payments that were made to the eligible recipients. And so I'm always a little bit startled when people say that's not appropriate for Black Americans. And I wonder why they feel that way. But a reparations program does not have to be restricted to that. There are other ways in which the funds could be dispersed besides direct payments to the eligible recipients. But I think for both substantive and symbolic reasons, an important component of any reparations program for Black American descendants of persons who were enslaved here must include payments to eligible recipients.
Do you see this as being a realistic? When I say realistic, I don't mean whether it's morally appropriate or economically necessary, but I say whether or not there's political will to do something like a full-scale reparations program in the United States, given that we've outlined all of the reasons why Black Americans in particular have been unfairly maligned by these economic policies. Do you actually see a future, Sandy, in which this is something that will have the political will behind it to actually happen?
So in my more pessimistic moments, I would probably give you a negative answer on that, in large part, because we have a Mitch McConnell-led Senate. And so I would think that the Senate would have to have a different composition for us to have a realistic opportunity for a reparations program to actually be enacted. However, there are some optimistic signs. So the first optimistic sign is the fact that we're actually having a national conversation about reparations now, a national conversation that actually has engaged folks who are serious candidates for the presidency. I think only one or two of them have actually endorsed a program of reparations. But several of them have indicated that they would support the formation of a commission. So to the extent that that's something that several of the candidates are in favor of, that's an excellent potential starting point for the development of a reparations program. I know that in the case of the Japanese American reparations program, it was preceded by a study commission, which engaged in two tasks. The first task was to set the historical record straight, to demonstrate that American officials knew that Japanese Americans were not a security threat, but still proceeded to have them placed in camps around the country. And then the second task that commission conducted was to design or develop a program of restitution. So I think it's entirely appropriate that we follow the same kind of pattern with respect to the development of a Black reparations program in the United States. And I think we have not had a conversation about reparations for Black Americans in the United States on this scale or on this order since the Reconstruction era.
William Sandy Darity is the director of the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke University. Sandy, thanks again for being with us.
Thank you.